Finch's Landing consisted of 366 steps down a high bluff and ending in a jetty. Farther downstream, beyond the bluff, were traces of an old cotton landing where Finch Negroes had loaded bales and produce, unloaded blocks of ice, flour and sugar, farm equipment, and feminine apparel. A two-rut road ran from the riverside and vanished among dark trees. At the end of the road was a two-storied white house with porches circling it upstairs and downstairs. In his old age, our ancestor, Simon Finch, had built it to please his nagging wife. But with the porches, all resemblance to ordinary houses of its era ended. The internal arrangements of the Finch house were indicative of Simon's guilelessness and the absolute trust with which he regarded his offspring. There were 6 bedrooms upstairs, 4 for the 8 female children, 1 for Welcome Finch, the sole son, and 1 for visiting relatives. Simple enough, but the daughters' rooms could be reached only by 1 staircase, Welcome's room and the guest room only by another. The daughters' staircase was in the ground floor bedroom of their parents, so Simon always knew the hours of his daughters' nocturnal comings and goings. There was a kitchen separate from the rest of the house, tacked onto it by a wooden catwalk. In the backyard was a rusty bell on a pole, used to summon field hands or as a distress signal. A widow's walk was on the roof, but no widow's walk there. From it, Simon oversaw his overseer, watched the riverboats, and gazed into the lives of surrounding landholders. There went with the house the usual legend about the Yankees. 1 Finch female, recently engaged, donned her complete trousseau to save it from raiders in the neighborhood. She became stuck in the door to the daughter's staircase, but was doused with water and finally pushed through. When we arrived at the landing, Aunt Alexandra kissed Uncle Jack. Francis kissed Uncle Jack. Uncle Jimmy shook hands silently with Uncle Jack. Jim and I gave our presents to Francis, who gave us a present. Jim felt his age and gravitated to the adults, leaving me to entertain our cousin. Francis was 8 and slicked back his hair. "What'd you get for Christmas?" I asked politely. "Just what I asked for," he said. Francis had requested a pair of knee pants, a red leather book sack, 5 shirts, and an untied bow tie. "That's nice," I lied. "Jim and I got air rifles, and Jim got a chemistry set. A toy one, I reckon." "No, a real one. He's going to make me some invisible ink, and I'm going to write to Dill in it." Francis asked what was the use of that. "Well, can't you just see his face when he gets a letter from me with nothing in it? It'll drive him nuts." Talking to Francis gave me the sensation of settling slowly to the bottom of the ocean. He was the most boring child I ever met. As he lived in Mobile, he could not inform on me to school authorities, but he managed to tell everything he knew to Aunt Alexandra, who in turn unburdened herself to Atticus, who either forgot it or gave me hell, whichever struck his fancy. But the only time I ever heard Atticus speak sharply to anyone was when I once heard him say, "Sister, I do the best I can with them." It had something to do with my going around in overalls. Aunt Alexandra was fanatical on the subject of my attire. I could not possibly hope to be a lady if I wore breeches. When I said I could do nothing in a dress, she said I wasn't supposed to be doing things that required pants. Aunt Alexandra's vision of my deportment involved playing with small stoves, tea sets, and wearing the add-a-pearl necklace she gave me when I was born. Furthermore, I should be a ray of sunshine in my father's lonely life. I suggested that one could be a ray of sunshine in pants just as well, but Auntie said that one had to behave like a sunbeam, that I was born good but had grown progressively worse every year. She hurt my feelings and set my teeth permanently on edge, but when I asked Atticus about it, he said there were already enough sunbeams in the family and to go on about my business. He didn't mind me much the way I was. At Christmas dinner, I sat at the little table in the dining room. Jim and Francis sat with the adults at the dining table. Auntie had continued to isolate me long after Jim and Francis graduated to the big table. I often wondered what she thought I'd do, get up and throw something. I sometimes thought of asking her if she would let me sit at the big table with the rest of them just once. I would prove to her how civilized I could be. After all, I ate at home every day with no major mishaps. When I begged Atticus to use his influence, he said he had none. We were guests, and we sat where she told us to sit. He also said Aunt Alexandra didn't understand girls much. She'd never had one. But her cooking made up for everything. 3 kinds of meat, summer vegetables from her pantry shelves, peach pickles, 2 kinds of cake, and ambrosia constituted a modest Christmas dinner. Afterwards, the adults made for the living room and sat around in a dazed condition. Jim lay on the floor, and I went to the backyard. "Put on your coat," said Atticus dreamily, so I didn't hear him. Francis sat beside me on the back steps. "That was the best yet," I said. "Grandma's a wonderful cook," said Francis. "She's going to teach me how." "Boys don't cook." I giggled at the thought of Jim in an apron. "Grandma says all men should learn to cook. The men ought to be careful with their wives and wait on them when they don't feel good," said my cousin. "I don't want Dill waiting on me," I said. "I'd rather wait on him." "Dill?" "Yeah. Don't say anything about it yet, but we're going to get married as soon as we're big enough. He asked me last summer." Francis hooted. "What's the matter with him?" I asked. "Ain't anything the matter with him. You mean that little runt Grandma says stays with Miss Rachel every summer?" "That's exactly who I mean." "I know all about him," said Francis. "What about him?"
"Grandma says he hasn't got a home."
"Has to. He lives in Meridian. He just gets passed around from relative to relative, and Miss Rachel keeps him every summer."
"Francis, that's not so."
Francis grinned at me. "You're mighty dumb sometimes, Jean Louise. Guess you don't know any better, though."
"What do you mean?"
"If Uncle Atticus lets you run around with stray dogs, that's his business, like Grandma says, so it ain't your fault." "I guess it ain't your fault if Uncle Atticus is a nigger lover besides, but I'm here to tell you it certainly does mortify the rest of the family."
"Francis, what the hell do you mean?"
"Just what I said. Grandma says it's bad enough he lets you all run wild, but now he's turned out a nigger lover, we'll never be able to walk the streets of Macon again. He's ruining the family, that's what he's doing." Francis rose and sprinted down the catwalk to the old kitchen. At a safe distance, he called. "He's nothing but a nigger lover."
"He is not," I roared. "I don't know what you're talking about, but you better cut it out this red-hot minute."
I leaped off the steps and ran down the catwalk. It was easy to collar Francis. I said, "Take it back quick." Francis jerked loose and sped into the old kitchen. "Nigger lover," he yelled.